Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everybody, welcome to this year-end 2019 edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you near the end of this year. What a crazy year it's been. I wanted to do a little bit of a reflection piece and also look forward a little bit to 2020. What's coming up? What can you expect this next year? Well, one of the things that's happened, as you may have recalled, if you heard my episode last week with Dr. Terry Daniel, there's been a lot of stuff that's gone down. My daughter's fiance unfortunately passed away just a few weeks ago in a tragic accident, and at just 24 years old, and so his funeral's coming up pretty soon. So things have kind of gone into hiatus mode. Everything's kind of shut down as we've been dealing with the after effects of that and supporting my daughter, which is obviously the most important thing right now going forward. So I haven't really done any interviews or whatever, but you know, I thought, then again, today, my last day at work for a couple weeks off, which is a much welcome break. I was thinking, you know, it might be okay, just take a few weeks off anyway and kind of get my head straight and deal with that. We've got, like I say, his funeral coming up soon. So I'm not really looking forward to that. That's going to be a very difficult day for everybody involved. His parents are obviously devastated and my daughter is just completely traumatized. And it's been a really horrible experience. And this is the last, hopefully, person that's died. I think I mentioned on the last podcast, we've had 10 people die in the last 23, 24 months, and that's just insane. I don't know who that happens to, but I've heard from a couple people, actually, that they've had similar kind of, you know, periods in their life where a bunch of people have died, but this has been absolutely insane. We've lost both my wife's parents. We've lost really good friends, family members, loved ones, not just people that were sort of like peripheral, but like really close friends, family members. And it's been a very difficult transition. But like I talked about with Terry Daniel, it's really an interesting perspective, though, because the analytical part of my brain, I can't help but stop and think about it from the point of view that, you know, when I was an evangelical Christian, I would have sought answers. And that's the thing, when you're faced with death, and especially a lot of death, you're seeking answers, and you want, you know, answers to life's big questions. And of course, in Christianity, you know, there's all sorts of prepackaged answers, and it seems to work, at least for the moment, to take refuge in what Robert Lifton calls loaded language, or in our case, we called it Christianese, you know, pat sort of slogans, easily memorable, sort of easy slogans that bring you comfort. But what I see now is actually, it's a way to stop critical thinking. It's a way to stop you thinking about the reality and from taking things to their kind of logical conclusion. So Christians will say things like, well, you know, God has a plan. God's trying to teach us something. You know, God must have needed another angel in his choir. God has a purpose, and we won't find out that purpose sometimes in this lifetime, but there's going to be an answer in heaven, and on it goes, and they'll quote Bible verses. In fact, my fundamentalist sister, who has completely disowned us because my oldest daughter is gay, and she posted a thing on Facebook a few months ago, a quote from Ken Ham ranting about the homosexual agenda and the gay lifestyle and how it's an abomination in front of God and blah, blah, blah. But what we did was we confronted that bullshit, and my sister blocked us all, and that was the end of that. We're like, fuck off, you know, that's the end of that. We don't need toxic people like you in our lives. And then she emailed me when she found out that my daughter's fiance Jack had died, and she couldn't help but turn it around onto herself. And then she concluded the email by quoting a couple of Bible verses. And my first response was to start a really nasty response and to go off on her. And again, it was those platitudes. It was all those sort of things she was quoting in her email. And I don't know what she was trying to do. I guess she can't help herself. Maybe that's the way they work. That's the way they think. These fundamentalists, these evangelicals, they have to turn it into some sort of a chance to proselytize, or a chance to like get the word out, even though I'm clearly, you know, I've left the fold and I've walked away from it all. there's still hope. There's still a chance. And so she had to end with a couple of Bible verses, you know. So that's just the way it goes. That's the way it is, you know. So I deleted my nasty response that I initially started to write. And I just turned around and said, hey, thanks for your condolences. Goodbye. And that was it. I thought, what's the point of engaging? Because engaging, getting into it with her is only going to cause more trouble. And she's not going to change her point of view. There's no question about that. Me saying anything, it's not any good. I'm a reprobate. I'm an apostate. You know, I've walked away from it all. I used to be a pastor and all the rest of it. And so she's really disappointed, and I'm sure she's hurt on some level, and she's afraid that I'm going to hell and my family's going to hell. My daughter certainly is going to hell because she's gay and she's married to a woman. So I'm pretty sure that'll do it, especially as she's quoting Ken Ham. But of course, her response to that was, well, I didn't say it. Ken Ham said it. Okay, so classic sort of passive-aggressive behavior, whatever. I've had enough of that, so I don't need toxic people like that in my life, and so we've actually cut a lot of people out of our lives that were just toxic, and unfortunately, a lot of them were evangelical Christians, or still are, so it's just the way it goes, you know, and I'm sure maybe some of you are, you know, can resonate with some of that. You know, friends and family can be awfully toxic and passive-aggressive if they're still in the faith, and they're trying to win us back into the fold, and doing all sorts of sneaky, underhanded things. I've heard stories about, like, Christian parents. Let's say you get your kids over there for a weekend or for a night to spend the night with grandma and grandpa, and they send them home with Bible tracts, or they send them home with a new Bible, you know, or they take them to church with them, despite you saying, no, I do not want you to take my children to your church, and they insist on doing it anyway. And, you know, there's all that kind of sort of manipulative, sneaky, passive-aggressive behavior. So it's par for the course. It's part of what you get from walking away from the faith and turning your back on the whole thing. And this is what made me thinking. I was thinking about this driving home from work the other day. You know, a lot has changed. Reflecting back on this last year, I started off almost exactly a year ago now, in January of 2019, I was starting this series on the cults. And as you've probably heard me say, if you've been listening a while now, what got me started on it was about October, November of 2018. It was a long time ago now. There was a series on the Crime and Investigation Channel here in the UK, and it was called Twisted Faith Week. And it was a series of documentaries about, I think it was five or six of them, every night of the week. They were about an hour long. And these documentaries were about cult survivors. And there was things like, you know, someone who survived the Nation of Islam, and ex-Scientologists, ex-Mormons, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Children of God. You know, and these are sort of like mainstream, classically defined, identifiable cults, no question about it. You know, cults like the FLDS and Warren Jeffs and things like that. We're talking, you know, cults with full-on compounds and razor wire and guards and people trying to escape and getting put in cells and being shut in places like the Hole, like Scientology does. And the FLDS will move you to another compound somewhere way out in remote part of the country. You know, they will literally just make you disappear if you try to escape too many times, you know. So these are classically sort of defined as cults. Everyone knows they're cults, and it's pretty clear that, you know, sociologists have identified all these sort of traits that these groups use. Well, as I've mentioned before, what got me to thinking about it was I was really blindsided. I was surprised by the fact that so many of the things that each ex-cultist that was telling his or her story, having come out of these cults, escaped the cults or whatever, I thought, okay, there's two things that's happening here. One is that everyone's story is remarkably similar. Even though they have different experiences, obviously, from Scientology to Children of God to Mormonism or Nation of Islam, the tactics are kind of there's a small group of cult control, mind control techniques and tactics that they were all subject to. And then the other thing that struck me was that I started thinking, wait a minute, that's remarkably eerily similar to my own experiences growing up in fundamentalist and evangelical Christianity. And that's what really led me to start investigating even more this element of cult psychology, cult mind control. And one of the first books I read was Dr. Robert J. Lifton's really seminal work on brainwashing in communist China. And it's called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, a Study of Brainwashing in Communist China. And this is what started opening the doors, opening my eyes to the fact that, yeah, I was raised in a cult. I was raised in the Bill Gothard cult by my parents, and me and my sisters were all part of this movement. And all of the things that Lifton described, and then I started reading other books like articles by Stephen Hassan, The Bite Model, Behavior Control, Information Control, Thought Control, Emotional Control. And I realized that all these people like Dr. Janja Lalich, who was a guest on the show just a few months ago, her book Take Back Your Life, articles and so forth, I'm reading all this stuff and it's blowing my mind and I'm thinking, my God, I was raised in a cult and it explains so much about what happened to me. And so rather than just, I guess, focusing on exploring the world of the cults, which is where I started with this idea last year, almost a year ago now, with this episode, is evangelicalism a cult? And I started going through and listing where I thought they hit all the markers that Lifton describes. There's sort of 8 classic markers of cults that he describes both in his book and in another article that he wrote called Cult Formation. If you want to look that up, it's a condensed version. It's only a few pages long, but he kind of goes through all these 8 markers of what cults do and how cult leaders are able to control and manipulate their followers. And I'm thinking, my God, this is what's happened to me. This is my story. And the more I researched it, the more I started talking about it, the more people were responding to it. I started meeting other people who were ex-cult members too, people like Chris Shelton, who is an ex-Scientologist, and Chris really opened my eyes to some pretty interesting things, and I've said this many, many times. One of the things I took from that first episode that I did with Chris Shelton was that he said, here's the thing, if you strip away the ideology from all of these groups with undue influence, you take the ideology away, the psychology is virtually the same. Group to group, cult to cult, church to church, it's very, very similar, markedly so. There's only a fairly small group of tactics or techniques that these cults and groups with undue influence use. That's why Lifton only has 8. Rick Ross, I think, has 10. And the other cult experts, they'll have about 4 or 5 kind of major big ticket ones, and they're all pretty much the same. They've got it figured out. And this is how cult leaders do it. This is how groups do it. This is how they exercise undue influence. So I met people like Chris Shelton, Brielle Decker Blanchard, who described her story of escaping from the FLDS cult. She was, I think, Warren Jeffs, something like his 65th wife when she was just 18 years old. And she has this amazing story of being locked in her brother's house because she tried to escape so many times from the various compounds. The windows were screwed shut. They were actually, she was locked in this room. The windows were actually screwed shut, and she found a broken off pair of scissors in the room, and she quietly unscrewed the screws out of the window frame, opened the window, crawled out and ran away and escaped. And she's been out ever since. I mean, just an amazing story, you know. And I've talked to people from Australia who are ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, Lara Caput and Stephen Unthank. And just a few weeks ago, I talked to Renee Cordescu. She's another ex-JW from Sydney, Australia. She was about ready to launch a massive protest of the Jehovah's Witnesses gathering in Melbourne. There was something like 50 or 60,000 JWs who were expected to show up to this thing, and she put this group together. And the funny thing was is the protest was called Love Never Shuns, because the theme of the JW conference was Love Never Fails. And so Renee and maybe a few hundred, I think, people, I saw some clips on Twitter and YouTube where they were protesting these people coming in and out of the conference center in Melbourne, and they got some reactions for sure. So they've definitely kind of raised the bar a little bit, raised some of the levels of awareness about how the Jehovah's Witnesses, and of course, again, other cults and other groups do this. They shun people who have left, people who are apostates, kind of like my sister did to me, which until this last email, I thought that was the end of her. I was never going to hear the end of her again. But anyway, that's just the way it is. But that's what groups do. And this is what Lifton calls the dispensing of existence. And that's when you leave a group and in their eyes, you no longer have the right to exist. So in their eyes, from their point of view, you're basically as good as dead. And that's what cults do. They dispense with your existence and you're done, and they don't want to hear from you, see you again, even to the point where they'll do this to family members. In fact, I remember, if you've seen the Louis Theroux documentaries that he did, I believe it was through the BBC, There's two episodes that he did with the Westboro Baptist Church. And in fact, there's a really good interview. And this is kind of an aside from the Louis Theroux thing, but it's on the NPR radio podcast. But it's definitely well worth looking up this episode. Try and find the interview with Megan Phelps Roper. And she's, of course, the granddaughter of Fred Phelps, who started the Westboro Baptist Church. And she describes her growing up in the church and then her kind of deconstruction and how that happened and how she got out. And now she's speaking out against some of the hate speech. But anyway, Louis Theroux, he does these two episodes. And one of them was he goes to Westboro Baptist Church and they give him kind of unprecedented access. And he goes through and he meets some of the various families. And surprisingly, it's a very small church. It's only maybe, I don't know, less than 35 to 50 people. They have massive coverage, of course, because the way they protest funerals and soldiers' funerals, and they pick it all over the place. You know, they're the God hates fags people and God hates Jews and all the rest of it. But then he goes back 5 years later, and this is what the fascinating second episode is. He goes back into Westboro Baptist 5 or so years later, and some of the people that he interviewed that were fairly young, some of the girls and some of the guys had been kicked out of the church. And this is the classic thing of dispensing of existence. And I remember there's a famous scene in the documentary where he's talking to one of the parents of one of these girls, now a young woman, who got kicked out of the church for wearing a bikini on holiday, on her vacation. And she'd been caught. Someone took a picture and it got back to the church and she got booted out for violating their purity culture rules, you know. So she got kicked out and they said, look, as far as we're concerned, she's not our daughter anymore. She's as good as dead to us. And Louis Theroux was like, really? I mean, at the end of the day, she is still your daughter. Don't you care about her as your daughter, as a human being? And the dad and mom were like, no. She's done. She's as good as dead to us. That's probably the most classic example in fundamentalist Christianity, for sure, of the dispensing of existence that I can think of. It's as clear as day, you know, and you hear about this kind of thing happening. Maybe you've had an experience of it yourself. So I don't know what your story is, but it got me to thinking, too, about my own journey going back. How did I get out of the church? How did I deconstruct? Because it was funny because, you know, I came out of being a pastor in Portland, Oregon. I was an elder and the pastor of this church just south of Portland in a place called Milwaukee, Oregon. For about 12 years I was there. I was just the drummer on the worship team. I was going to Bible college in Portland at the time. And we were just attending the church as you do. I was looking to play, get into the worship band, and I enjoyed that. And then as I went on in my education and I got up into finishing up Bible college, then I started an MA at a local seminary in Portland. I got into leadership. I became an elder there. I led small groups for years, taught, preached sermons, did all that kind of stuff. Then eventually I got on the elder board as a staff member, and then we reorganized things, and then I became the senior pastor for the last couple, 3 or 4 years. I don't know how long it was, but that church ended up closing down because it was heading to an ugly split. And I walked away from that experience. I was completely burned out on the idea of church. I didn't want to have anything to do with church again. But when we came over here to the UK just a few months after that whole thing had gone down, I didn't want to go to church again. And my wife didn't want to go. We were like, no, screw that. But we got stuck with a family. I mean, they're nice people. They took us in, which is good. We didn't have anywhere to live when we first got here. They let us stay with them, even though they really didn't know us at all. They let us stay with them for about a month. And off the back of that, they were like, well, you've got to come to our church because we've been telling everybody about you and everyone's super excited. Everyone wants to meet you. So you got to come this Sunday. We're like, oh my God, you know, we don't want to go to church. But I will say, in a way, that kind of restored our faith in Christians, at least for a while, because people just kind of loved on us. We kind of healed up. We were completely burned out, completely raw. And we stayed for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, maybe almost 6 years in the end. But what was interesting about the whole experience was I kind of got into a little bit of leadership. We led a home group there and we were in some meetings and things like that. And I would talk to the elders and they obviously knew I'd come over. I was doing a PhD at the University of Chester, you know, so I was into academics. I had been a pastor and an elder. I had a backstory in church ministry. You know, I wasn't just some, you know, novice Christian off the streets. I had a kind of a valid backstory. I had a degree. I had 2 master's degrees. I'd done a Bible college degree. I mean, I had the qualifications, You know, I wasn't a lightweight, I guess, from that point of view. And I was doing a PhD. I was studying preaching at the University of Chester in biblical studies. You know, so we got into it. But one of the things that was happening was I was studying sort of the background of preaching, and I got into this discussion on the history of rhetoric. And I won't bore you with the details because I could talk for hours on this stuff. I'm really fascinated by it. But you go all the way back to ancient Greece, and that's where the art of rhetoric or persuasive speech comes from. They first started writing books about it when they noticed how it worked in certain circumstances when someone would have a speech that would be persuasive and would, you know, influence the crowd to do one thing or another. People started saying, well, what was it about that speech that actually was persuasive? What are the elements that worked, and what are the elements in someone else's speeches that didn't work? And so this is where the first sort of handbooks, if you will, about rhetoric and persuasive argumentation, persuasive speech comes from. And this is the basis of Christian preaching, because most of the first, the church fathers, if you look at the church history books, most of them were actually teachers of rhetoric themselves. It was an actual part of the curriculum in Greece and then on into Rome, because a lot of the Romans would just use Greek teachers, and they copied a lot of things from Greece. They admired the Greeks. They thought they were quite an advanced civilization, which they really were. They just stole a lot of things from Greece, and rhetoric was one of these things. So it became quite prominent in Rome as well. And when the first Christians came around, you know, they were already teachers of rhetoric, and so they just applied a lot of the rules to Christian preaching. And that's where the first preaching manuals and preaching handbooks kind of come from. It's a fusion of classical Greek rhetoric together with the proclamation of the Bible, and they call these things homilies or sermons, and that's where the word homiletics or preaching comes from. That's the sort of real brief history of preaching, and it's just developed, obviously, over the centuries. There's been hundreds and thousands of books and volumes written on what makes effective preaching, blah, blah, blah. So I'm studying all this stuff anyway, to make a long story longer. And I'm sitting in church every Sunday. And what I was doing, I'm a critical thinker, and I'm applying the things that I'm learning in my research and my writing on rhetoric and preaching and the history of all this stuff. I'm applying it to what I'm hearing the preacher up there preaching every Sunday. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm evaluating this person. How is he or she actually accomplishing, let's say, their rhetorical strategy? In other words, when you get ready to give a sermon or give a speech, you have some hoped for outcome in mind. You want to do something. You want to achieve something in your listeners. You want them to change their attitudes, their values, their behaviors, their thinking, whatever it might be. You have an ideal outcome in your mind. And so what you do is you select essentially a rhetorical strategy by which you think is going to be the most effective means of persuasion to influence your listeners. And this is essentially how preaching works. And so I was applying all these tools and these models onto the sermons. And what struck me is that how flimsy a lot of it was. And I'm like, okay, so I see what you're trying to do, and I think I know how you're trying to get it done. I happen to disagree, and I think it's manipulative, and some of the conclusions you're drawing are kind of bogus and specious. And so I was starting to question that, and I was also reading a lot of progressive Christian authors like Brian McLaren, Rob Bell, Donald Miller. And so I'd already started to jettison a lot of my, I guess, evangelical or fundamentalist things, my beliefs that I really thought I absolutely had to have. You know, I had to retain them all at any cost. I was jettisoning a lot of these things, and I was questioning a lot of stuff. And what started to do it for me was I would sit in church, and not only was I having increasing problems with the methods that were being used by these various preachers, and I went to the elder board a few times and had a few discussions about some of the things I disagreed with, and their attitude was, well, you know, we hear you, but we disagree. We don't think there's a problem. So, you know, thank you for coming in. And I'm like, what the hell, dude? I mean, I'm giving you what I think are pretty reasoned, pretty sound argumentation to show you there's some kind of fundamental problems here. And you're kind of, you know, handshake, thank you for coming in. We hear you, but we don't think your point is valid. We're just going to carry on as we're going. Wow. You know, I'm like, really? You don't want to hear some critical thinking, huh? And what started doing it for me was this idea that I'm hearing a lot of guilt and shame coming from the pulpit. And I'm realizing, God, I mean, not only is it shaming me, but I personally don't own this stuff. And one of the things that really got to me was I started playing American football about 2 or 3 years after we got to this country, British American football. You may not understand that, but it's actually a thing. It's the fastest growing sport here in the UK, both men's and women's American football. It's a thing. I still coach. I played for the Chester Romans American Football Club for about 8 seasons. I played offensive line. I played tight end, you know, and I did all those things. And one of the things was we had practice about 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoons. And I knew I had to sneak out of church a bit early. So I went to the elders. I mean, I was upfront about it. I said, hey, you know, I'm going to be playing American football. It starts at 1 o'clock. So if you see me sneaking out the back, it's not because I'm leaving and trying to get out early. I've got to go to practice. And the way I sold it to the elders was I said, look, you're always talking about being missional. And that's the key word in evangelicalism. You've got to be missional, meaning you got to go out into the world and build relationships with non-Christians for the purpose of having conversations about the gospel. And that's what missional, being missional is all about. And I said, look, I'm being missional. I'm the only Christian on the team. There's 35, 40 guys playing American football. I'm the only one that's a Christian. And I've got this amazing chance. This is my mission field here, this American football club. And so they were like, well, that's cool. You know, at least you're doing it for all the right reasons. So I would sneak out of church early. Well, that was a good excuse to get out. But another thing that it did for me, though, is that for the first time in my life as a Christian, I actually had more relationships, real profound relationships with non-Christians than I did with Christians, because I'd always been in the Christian bubble growing up in the church. I went to Bible college, seminary, then I was an elder and a pastor. I was trapped in the Christian bubble pretty much all my life. I barely had any relationships with non-Christians, even though as a pastor, I had always told people that they needed to be evangelizing more and proselytizing more. I myself was barely doing it myself. So here I was, for the first time in my life, I was actually doing what I thought I was supposed to be doing. I was building relationships. I was being missional. I was going out and having these conversations. And I genuinely was, because, you know, I was the only American on the team. I was the only Christian. And they'd ask me, what are you even doing in this country? And I'd say, well, I'm going to University of Chester. What are you studying? Well, theology, religious studies, preaching. And they're like, what? What the hell? I mean, you got long hair, tattoos, beard. You don't look like the typical sort of Christian scholar kind of guy. And that would always lead to these conversations about spirituality. And I had a lot of them with these guys. And it was genuine friends. You know, we'd go out to the pub and have pints. And, you know, we did all kinds of stuff outside of playing American football. But as I'm sitting in churches and all this is going on, I'm feeling finally pretty good about myself that I'm actually practicing what I was preaching. And what I was hearing, though, from the pulpit was, you're not doing enough. You're not evangelizing. You need to build relationships with your friends and coworkers and neighbors and relatives. And I'm like, hang on a minute. First of all, I don't own what you're telling me, because I am doing that. And secondly, I'm looking around this room and I'm looking at the faces of all the people in the room who are hearing you heap all this guilt and shame on them. And they are looking like, oh my God, you know, you're right. You're so right, preacher. I'm worthless. I'm a piece of shit, you know, and I got to beg God for forgiveness, and I've got to ask for boldness so I can proclaim the gospel. And I'm like, wait a minute. I mean, how does this work? You're heaping all this guilt and shame on people. I'm not owning it for myself, because I think, wait a minute, I am doing it, and I'm seeing all this shame and guilt you're heaping on them. And beyond that, I'm starting to question whether or not the preacher is doing it him or herself, when I highly doubted that they had any relationships with a single non-Christian. And yet they're telling us to do all this stuff that they themselves weren't even doing. And then what the preacher would do after laying this burden on all these people, making them feel terrible about how they failed God and they failed the church and they failed each other and haven't lived up to the standards God requires of them and on and on and on. Then they'd turn around and say something like this. They'd say, listen, if you need boldness, if you feel bad about how you're letting God down and the church down, you need to come forward and pray that the Holy Spirit will give you power to make you a better witness and a more effective evangelist out there in the world. You need to come to the front. We're going to pray for boldness. We're going to give you this impartation of God's power so you can go out and preach the gospel. And I'm like, what the hell, man? You're the one who's laid that on these people. This is bullshit. How's God going to bail you out now after you've stuck all this onto these people? You know, so I was getting increasingly angry, and that's when I really noticed there was a difference where I was thinking, okay, I'm okay to sneak out to go to American football, but the services that I was there, I'm going, wait a minute. I mean, how in the hell is this working? And what really hit me was when I realized that I, as a preacher, I used to do the same thing. And I used to tell people the exact same things because I thought that's what you had to do. You had to kind of beat the sheep, you know, whip them into shape and make them feel bad about themselves and lay some guilt and shame on them. And that'll motivate them to witness and do all the things that God, you know, wants them to do and they're supposed to be doing and blah, blah, blah. And it really made me walk away and go, what the hell? I mean, what was I doing as a pastor and what are these people doing to these other congregation members? I'm not buying it. I'm not doing it. And so that was one of the big things when I realized I was walking away angry every Sunday and I'd go home and rant all the way home. And my wife would be like, my God, I mean, are you listening to yourself? Can you hear yourself talking? You need to get out of this thing. I mean, if you're that angry and upset every time, no one's listening to you, by the way. They're not listening to anything you say. You have gone to the elders and you've expressed your concerns. They've blown you off. No one's listening. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I got to get out. I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to walk away angry every Sunday. So we quit going to church, kind of faded away. And of course, you know, barely anybody said anything or noticed. I think they kind of figured it out that I was sneaking out the back door and I just kept going. I didn't come back, you know, and that's just a classic case, isn't it? You just kind of fade away and then no one ever thinks of you again and off you go. But I was still teaching. That's the thing. I was teaching at a Bible college as I was finishing up my PhD. And then after I got done, I taught for about 6 or 8 years at this Bible college and it had regional centers all over the country. And I would go to Liverpool and Leeds every week and I would teach all these, you know, aspiring ministry students. And the one thing that I at least could say to them, I was questioning a lot of the dogma and a lot of the things I was deconstructing. I was jettisoning, as I say, a lot of my sort of preconceived notions and presuppositions and things that I thought I had to retain. But at least I could say to them, look, you know, I'm being missional. This is what I do in my life. And I can show you examples of how to do this, how to actually build relationships with people. But then as time went on, I got increasingly upset at the way that this Christian college was treating so terribly both their staff and the students. Just shocking stuff that went on. You know, they screwed people over. I could tell you story after story of they screwed me over. They screwed many people over, staff and students alike. And so I was getting increasingly upset at the fact that I felt like they were hypocritical and, you know, they had a major integrity problem. And they're, you know, talking about being missional and being all this, you know, stuff for Christ. And yet their business practices were actually shocking. And they finally made me redundant. And that's what they say in this country, which is basically saying you got laid off. They ended up getting £450,000 in debt. They just completely screwed themselves over, and in the process, they screwed all of us over because they laid off most of their teaching staff, and I was one of those people that got made redundant. And I remember it's funny now, but I was pretty pissed off at the time. I came home, it was about middle of December, I think it was 2016, my last term there, that I'd been made redundant, and I wasn't going to be coming back in January, and I was done. They were, you know, giving me the boot along with everybody else. And there was a letter sitting on the kitchen table from the college. And my wife's like, here, open this letter. This, you know, maybe it's a kind of a, you know, thank you for your 8 years of service. We're so sorry that you've had to, you know, get made redundant, and we wish you all the best. And as soon as we get financially solvent, we'll try to get you back. And I'm thinking, okay, that's probably what this is. I open it up and it's a letter from the president, what they call the principal in this country, but the president of the college. And he says, you know, as you know, we're in terrible financial straits. Would you prayerfully consider donating your final month's salary to the Bible college to help us through this rough time because we're so far in debt? And I'm like, fuck off. You just screwed everybody over, including me. You want me to donate my last month's salary? Piss off. Needless to say, I did not donate my final salary, and I never looked back. But now I see they did me a favor. That was the best thing they could have ever done for me by making me redundant. I was so wound up about all the bullshit that they were doing and the theology that I was being forced to teach, kind of going down the party line, that I see now they basically released me from all that, you know. So I was too far gone anyway by that point. So, you know, that was kind of my deconstruction. And it's something that Dave Warnock said, one of the guests I had a few months ago. He said, you know, why did he leave evangelicalism? It was the death of a thousand cuts. It wasn't just one thing. It was a thousand things that all added up. You know, one little slice isn't going to kill you, but if you get a thousand cuts, you're going to bleed to death. You know, and for me, the last straw of identifying as a Christian was when I saw the evangelical support for Donald Trump back in 2016. And I'm like, okay, that is officially me done. I do not want to be called a Christian ever again. I was sickened by it and angered by it. But, you know, I have to say there's also been a major shift in my thinking, because up to that point, it was all about the deconstruction and the anger and the bitterness and rage and kind of vomiting and spewing out all this stuff. But talking with Stacy Ray a couple years ago when we did our live podcast in Seattle in September 2018, that was a major turning point, because we started to focus on reconstruction after deconstruction. And that is a very critical turning point, I think, in my life, and I think in the lives of a lot of other people, because if you focus on just deconstructing, you could easily find yourself wallowing in the rage and the anger, the betrayal, the bitterness, all the hurt. And yes, you do need to work through that. You need to walk through that time. You got to sit in that for a while. But if you stay there too long, that can become very toxic and unhealthy. And that's been a major shift in sort of my life. And I think hopefully that's helped a lot of people too, focusing on reconstructing, rebuilding your identity after you leave a cult or a destructive religion or a controlling sort of group with undue influence. And I would say that it was really at that point in time that I had a major shift in focus, when I was really focusing on the reconstruction piece of it all. That's what's taken me into the realms of cult psychology and cult tactics. Because I think once you understand how you were controlled and manipulated by these groups, that's when you start to disempower the tactics and the psychology, and you can start to unpick the conditioning, as John Atack, ex-Scientologist, said. That's what you have to do. You've got to figure out how you were controlled, how you were manipulated, and that's really what I focused on a lot of last year. In a lot of the podcast episodes and the guests that I had on the show, I've gone on this sort of, you know, cult journey, and I've studied dominion theology, and it's taken me into all sorts of bizarre places. I've talked to people like Dr. Andre Gagné, and we took a deep dive into dominion theology, and that has just fueled my interest. I've gone on to do more research on this subject. I've been talking to people who are experts in this area of dominion theology. And look for that coming in 2020. There's going to be a whole lot more of this stuff. The more you go down the rabbit hole, it's freaky, and it's quite scary, and it's quite angering to see how far some of these right-wing fundamentalists and evangelicals and Seven Mountains Dominion theologians and all these other labels they have for themselves, how far they've infiltrated. If you've seen the series The Family on Netflix, it was from a book written by Jeff Charlotte. You need to watch that, because it'll freak you out. That's what started me on this whole nother sort of journey that I've been studying. When I saw that series on Netflix, I'm like, what the hell is going on here? I knew a little bit about that, but I didn't realize how far the religious right had infiltrated not just Washington, D.C., but all over the world, the corridors of power all over the world. So there's some scary shit going on, and I'm going to keep researching that. I've been talking to some people on Twitter quite a bit, getting some help in my research on this area of dominion theology. I've been compiling a document on Google. I don't know, I'm probably up to 45, 50 pages of quotes and stuff that every time I find more information, I just stick it in that document. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with that. I might end up trying to get a book out of that. So that's something that sort of overlaps with cult psychology, because there's a lot of stuff in dominionism that I can see right away relates to, certainly, for example, Robert Lifton's 8 markers of cults. One of the things is loaded language. They use code words. They'll say words that sound like you think you know what they're talking about, but to them, it's loaded. And that's what Lifton says, that loaded language in a group like that is loaded with their ideology, and they know what it means. They'll say things like family values, but what they mean is anti-LGBTQ. They're talking about one man, one woman marriage only. And that's what they mean when they say family values. They'll say things like biblical worldview. You know, they'll talk about prayer. And you think, oh, we're just praying to God. No, they're talking about when they say prayer, they are talking about spiritual warfare. They're talking about spiritual mapping. They're talking about spirits over territories and regions and cities and demons who control areas and tearing down strongholds and breaking through gates. And I mean, there's an entire theology of prayer going on there. So that's loaded language. There's dozens more I could start to name, but loaded language, sacred science is another one. Of course, they talk about the Bible, but to them, it's the sacred book. It's the inspired, inerrant, infallible, authoritative word of God, and everything they take their mandate, they say it's from the Bible. And so that's how they live their life. That's what they mean when they say biblical worldview. And then, of course, it is the doctrine over person. And that's another one, is when they say we take the Bible as the word of God. Don't blame me. It's not me who's saying it. It's God. So if you're offended by the fact that God defines marriage as between a man and a woman, and if you're gay or trans or something like that, you don't fit that paradigm, don't be upset with me. It's God. God is the one who's defined it. God is the one who said it. So that's a classic case of Lifton's markers of a cult, is doctrine over person. Our doctrine, our sacred science, is more important than you, the person. If your feelings are offended or hurt by what we say, that's your problem. And that's a classic case of doctrine over person. So there's three markers of cults that I can identify right off the bat with Dominion Theology, Seven Mountains Dominion Theology, Christian Reconstructionism, whatever you want to call it. It's pretty bizarre. So look for some of that coming up in 2019. So thanks for joining me on this rant, this journey of talking about reflection. Looking forward a little bit to what's coming next year in 2020. And keep in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018 and get a hold of me there. You can also like the MindShift Podcast Facebook page, and you can send me an email through that as well if you want to talk to me, chat or whatever. I also want to say a huge thank you to all the people this year in 2019 who supported this show on Patreon. That is hugely appreciated. I would much rather do it that way than try to get advertisers or whatever to support me in the work that I do. It is a tremendous amount of work to interview people and edit the show. I do all the work myself. So if you think that is worthy of your support in 2020 financially to pay me for basically my time and my effort, then by all means support me on Patreon. The links to that are in the show notes, how you can find the MindShift Podcast Patreon page. So once again, thanks for joining me. I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. Thanks for coming along with me in 2019. I hope you stay along for the ride in 2020. I'm super excited to be doing this podcast, and I look forward to some amazing episodes coming up next year. So I'll see you right here on MindShift Podcast.